Okay, it is recording.
Great. So I want to thank Howard Cola for having me today. I know I've come and give a variety of presentations in the past, but I always love coming to talk to this group. If you could hold your comments and questions to the end, that would be great. If you've got a chat you can enter them into, Sharon's going to monitor that for me. I'd also ask if you could put yourself on mute. It'll just be easier for everybody else to hear and for the recording to be clear. And then finally, I will provide my contact information at the end if you want to reach me, if just because the communication isn't very great or you come up with some questions later, I'll provide an email address if you've got questions later. So my name is Christine Herwig. For the past 7 years, I was the regional non-game specialist for Northwest Minnesota. I'm currently the Northwest Assistant Regional Manager with the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for the Department of Natural Resources. So just to remind you all, non-game wildlife program, that's the program that I was in. Non-game wildlife are those species that are not hunted, fished, or trapped. And it includes animals from all the different animal groups, so mammals, birds, amphibians, even invertebrates like mussels and insects. And we don't get tax dollars, we don't get money from hunting and fishing license sales, we don't get money from parks passes. The majority of our funding comes from donations, either on your tax forms when they ask you if you want to give to the non-game fund, those are the dollars that come to us, or you can go to our website and give a donation, and the rest of our funding largely comes from grants. Northwestern Minnesota is a fairly large area. I've got a map down at the bottom there. That is our area of coverage. It's the area I supervise, and it's the area of coverage for our non-game staff shown here. We recently hired Amy Westmark as the new regional non-game specialist. She's fabulous. She's very knowledgeable. And if there's a presentation you want in the future, or if you have any other questions about non-game, she's going to be a great resource. We also still have our longtime non-game technician, Bruce Lenning. And again, I'll give you their email addresses at the end of the presentation if you have questions or anything that you'd like to ask them about. All right, so Sharon and I have been talking about this presentation for over a year now. And when we originally talked about it, it was going to be on loon monitoring. But more recently, she said, hey, I'm also intrigued to know I've been seeing more cardinals and more sandhill cranes. Could you talk about it? And normally when I give a presentation, I like there to be an ongoing theme throughout. So I was trying to think, how do you connect loons and cardinals? And well, the first thing you do is Christine? You try Google, right?
Yes. Oh, okay. That's what you're doing. I was going to tell you, you have a Google thing up. Okay.
Yep. No.
All right.
So I looked up loons and cardinals, and wouldn't you know, somebody has connected loons and cardinals. There was an article on sports teams logos. I'm not going to talk about sports teams logos today, but you can connect loons and cardinals. What I decided to talk about today, though, was change, and hopefully you'll see the theme as I go through the presentation. I'm going to talk specifically about environmental change. So there are many sources of environmental change, climate, invasive species. Many of you are familiar with aquatic invasive species, land development. These are just some examples of change that are out there. And there are many impacts, both positive and negative. Again, just some examples, public safety, surface and groundwater supplies, recreational opportunities, biodiversity. What I want to talk about today is some observations folks have made about birds. So the first one I want to talk about is range expansion. So most of our birds have a distribution range, and these do change through time. And the cardinal is one of the examples where their range has expanded. It's grown larger. So the northern cardinal, these maps that I have shown here are from Project Feeder Watch, which is a survey that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology has been doing for over 30 years now. And you can see this is a survey where they have you monitor feeders during winter months. And you can see the figure from 1989 to 1990 looks different than the figure from 2015 and 2016. Northern Minnesota really didn't have a lot of cardinals being detected at feeders in the late 1980s. We can look at this using some other data. This is another federal survey. It's called the Breeding Bird Survey. And this survey is a 25-mile long route that people drive and count birds along. It's conducted all across the U.S. and in southern Canada, and it's been going on since 1966, so it's a pretty good long data set. and people record every bird that they hear and see along that 25-mile route. And what I want to point out with this map here is when they looked at the changes from 1966 to 2015, they have been seeing range expansion of cardinals during the breeding season as well. And so what I want to point out here is the dark blue area of the map is the area where cardinals are expanding. So clearly they're heading north and they're joining us up here in northern Minnesota. I know at my house, I've lived here now 12 years. I've had cardinals at my feeders during the summer just twice in the last 10 years. But if you look at the Minnesota map, I'm at the pretty far north area for cardinals right now. Other species where we're seeing range expansions include the black-billed magpie. The example I have here is from a field guide. You often see this if you look at field guides. The purple area is where the birds were historically. The lighter purple area is where they've been seen more regularly. And then the dashed line shows where occasional observations can be found. Prior to European settlement, the species was located in the Great Plains, and they were following along, following the tribes as they were hunting bison, and they would take advantage of the scraps that were left behind. As bison were slaughtered by the new settlers, the magpie's range actually receded to the west. They were also considered vermin for a long time, and they were persecuted. But since some of those things have changed, and our landscape has changed, these birds have largely expanded and gone beyond their original range due to their adaptability to human-modified landscapes. One thing I wanted to mention, I'm going to go back to cardinals for a second. I just wanted to explain some of the reasons for some of these changes. For cardinals, they think warming temperatures, the fragmentation of forested landscapes, because these birds like edges of forests and shrubby areas, and the popularity of winter feeding is what really have caused the cardinals to move further north. All right, so let's move on to another expansion example. Red-bellied woodpeckers. Here I've got Christmas bird count data. This is collected by the National Audubon Society. If you haven't taken part in a Christmas bird count, they have 15-mile radius circles that they count all the birds in during right around the Christmas holiday. And the map on the left shows data from 1910 to 1939. The gray circles are areas where they counted birds, but they did not have red-bellied woodpeckers, and the red circles are where they had red-bellied woodpeckers. What's exciting about this survey is they've been doing this survey for over 100 years, so we have really good information about bird distributions during winter months. And you can see here, if you look at the map on the right, we really are seeing a lot more of the species further north and further west. And again, they think changes to our forest landscape are what are helping the species. There's been some changes to the wooded floodplains that they like, as well as tree plantings in urban areas, which have a tendency to get quite large and quite old. Some other reasons that we're seeing some more species are species recoveries. So bald eagles and ospreys shown here, those species had really declined in the 50s, 60s, and maybe even early 70s, largely due to a pesticide called DDT. What was happening is the birds' eggshells were getting thin, and when the adults went to sit on the eggs to incubate them, they would crush the eggs. So we had many years with no or very little reproduction that was occurring. That chemical was banned in the 70s, and it's taken a while, but both of these populations have really come back, and now both ospreys and eagles are very commonly seen throughout the Northland. Sandhill cranes have a slightly different fate. They were over-harvested in the late 1800s. We didn't have the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that protects most of our birds today, and this species was hunted to near extinction throughout much of its range. The sandhill crane is also a really slow breeder. They only have up to maybe two or three colts a year, young a year, and it takes them a long time to become mature to start breeding. And so it's only been the last maybe 20 years that sandhill cranes have been considered maybe common here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Another reason for expansion is restoration. So all three species shown here, wild turkeys, Canada geese, and trumpeter swans, 100 years ago, these were not found in Minnesota, are certainly not very common. And through the efforts of private organizations, as well as state and federal agencies, we've intentionally reintroduced these birds to different areas of the state. And all three of these birds are doing much better, and their populations have expanded to take advantage of all the habitat that we have to offer here in Minnesota. In addition to range expansions, we do have some species that are dealing with range contractions, or their ranges are getting smaller. And one example I have here is evening grosbeak. Again, this is the Project Feeder Watch data. There's 30 years of winter bird feeder data that they use. In 1989 and 1999, you can see that these birds were found pretty commonly across the boreal forest of Canada. And they were also found in a lot of our mountain ranges, including the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains. If you look at the more current data from 2010 to 2016, we've virtually lost these birds in the Appalachian Mountains as well as New England, and we are losing them here in Minnesota. They like coniferous trees. They like they get that big, heavy bill because they like to eat cones. And so we're still trying to investigate why this species is declining, and numerically, the decline has been pretty drastic. Environment Canada, one of the Canadian agencies, has acknowledged that although the reasons for decline aren't clear, they're suggested multiple causes, including large-scale forestry that's reduced the age structure of forests. These birds like older forest as well. The species is susceptible to diseases like West Nile virus. And then the species also used to rely really heavily on insect outbreaks. So spruce budworm is a preferred food source for them. And anytime there was a spruce budworm outbreak, their populations would increase because it'd be a great food source out there for them. And through our management and other factors like climate change, those spruce budworm outbreaks are declining. A few more reasons why this species is declining. They seem to be particularly susceptible to window strikes. So as they're migrating around, they fly into our windows. And then there's been some analyses to look at how they might be affected by climate change. And they are also expected to do poorly under a variety of climate change scenarios. So there probably isn't one thing affecting our grosbeaks. It's probably a lot of things, but there's still more work to be done to understand why they're declining so rapidly. Another species that's experienced some range contractions is the greater prairie chicken. They actually have an interesting change in distribution. They actually expanded in the late 1800s as we were breaking land to add agriculture. They expanded into Minnesota. But in recent years, they've really declined. You can see they're only found in the western part of the state. These data here are the Minnesota Breeding Bird Atlas. If you're interested in knowing more about our birds and some of the history of how they've, how their numbers and distributions have changed in Minnesota, I encourage you to check out the website. It's really an amazing repository of data and data summaries for all of the bird species we have here in Minnesota. But hunting pressure and more efficient farming replaced the mosaic of pastures, croplands, and native grasslands that were ideal habitat for this species. And it was estimated that these populations were the highest when croplands were only about 20 or 30% of the landscape. Today, we've lost a lot of our prairie here in Minnesota. This map shows what the habitat looked like in the, from like 1850 to about 1900. All the yellow and tan areas were our prairie. We had about 18 million acres, or about a third of the state was in prairie at the turn of the century. But the red areas that are shown here is how much prairie we had left in 2011. Around then, we had about 200,000 acres of prairie, of which only about 100,000 acres were in some sort of land protection. So that's a significant decline for any of our prairie species, but prairie chickens are large and obvious and easy to survey, so we know a little bit more about them. So how do we know about all of these changes? Well, we know about these changes because people have made the effort to collect data and to do some monitoring. I've got pictures here. All of these people are colleagues, friends, interns, and citizens that I've worked with over the years. Note all the happy, smiling faces as they're working with animals. It's really the work of a large number of people to be able to have the data and present the data that I was able to share with you. Who does data collection? Well, agencies and nonprofit organizations tend to be the folks that set up and develop the protocols, and they often house the data for these monitoring programs. And sometimes staff from these agencies and nonprofit organizations collect the data, but really most of the data collection we do in the United States relies very heavily on volunteers. And so you could be part of this data collection if you're not already. And there are many existing opportunities. I've just got a few examples here about some surveys or monitoring you can do for birds, insects, amphibians, and reptiles, but there are so many different ways you can take part in monitoring. And I know as lake associations, many of you are involved in AIS monitoring. You all gave updates on the monitoring that you're doing on your lakes, as well as water quality monitoring. But if you're interested in wildlife, there's plenty of opportunities for you to get involved. And what's great is for all of these different kinds of monitoring opportunities, most of these organizations have great background. They have excellent resources that teach you about these animals, and they often have really good newsletters giving you updates on how their organization is doing or how the species are doing. So if you're interested, please do check into it. But here I am tying to loon monitoring. The Minnesota DNR has two loon monitoring programs. One of them is called the Minnesota Loon Monitoring Program. The other is called Loon Watcher. And they both collect different types of data, which is why we've continued to have both of these monitoring programs. The Loon Monitoring Program collects data at about 600 of lakes, and they're the same 600 lakes every year. The black blobs that are shown on my map here, there's about 100 lakes in each of those little blobs. And this survey has a pretty specific protocol. You have to collect the number of adults and the number of chicks within a 10-day window right around the 4th of July. It's mostly a volunteer survey, but we have DNR staff that go out and fill in if we can't find volunteers for the lake. So we have over 25 years of data for 600 specific lakes. Loon Watcher is a little bit different. Anybody who wants to submit data on loons on a lake could submit data to Loon Watcher. The type of data collected is a little bit different. They're looking a little bit more closely at the life history of loons. So they want to know when they return to your lake, when they start nesting, when you first start seeing chicks. Do you have both chicks all summer? Do you lose some of the chicks? They want a little bit more in-depth information about how the loons are doing. The other benefit to the survey is we get statewide data. Basically, anybody across the state can submit data. The downside with this survey, though, is we do have a number of volunteers that either stop or pause their data collection. So lakes effectively kind of blink in and out. So we don't have as consistent data as we have with the loon monitoring program. So we get different types of data, and you can look at different kinds of trends with these two different surveys. So why do we monitor loons? Well, there have been some historical declines with this species, and we know that some areas in North America are still experiencing decline. So here I've got some data. There's 40 years of data from Ontario, and they're finding that the number of chicks per pair is declining in the lakes that they're monitoring. The other reason why we think it's important to monitor loons in Minnesota is that Minnesota has over 50% of the breeding adults in North America, in the lower 48 states. So whatever happens in Minnesota is probably indicative of the greater population, and it's important to understand that. Loons are also good indicators of water quality. They like clean, clear water because they're visual predators. They have to see the fish and frogs and insects to be able to catch them. And so how the loon population might adjust to different conditions, we might learn how other wildlife are responding, as well as maybe some information about the quality of some of our lakes. I'd also say people care about loons and are excited about loons, so they want to know that our loon population is doing well. So again, I did a quick Google search, and there's tons of logos that have loons on them. These are just a few examples here, but there's lots of private companies that do. And to me, this tells me, you know, when you build a logo for your company or for your sports team, you're trying to pick something that people can relate to or something that they love. And the fact that we use loons in all sorts of logos tells me that people love loons, and they're proud of them, and they like to show them on their t-shirts and with their sports teams. But sometimes we love them a little too much. Disturbance is one of the factors we're concerned about. We also know that there's a number of other human-caused effects. And by monitoring, it can help us figure out where we want to learn more about those effects. So loons get tangled in fishing equipment. They eat lead sinkers. They're prone to disease in some parts of the state and some parts of the country. And by monitoring them, we can have a better understanding of what's affecting them. So I want to move on and talk a little bit more specifically about data collection. I know Sharon said Hubbard Cola started doing some loon monitoring, but not all the lakes are doing data collection. And even when we do data collection, it's important that we collect good quality data so we can analyze it and learn from it. And so one point I want to make here is that consistency is key. It's important that you follow the protocols that you're given. I encourage most of my volunteers to reread the protocols every year, so we make sure you're following the protocol. And then the other point I wanted to make is, if you want to talk about trends, whether they're birds or water quality or anything, if you want to look at changes through time, you really need long-term data. When you're talking about wildlife populations, I've talked to some statisticians, and many of them will say you really need at least 10 years of data to say you're looking at long-term data collect, or that you're looking at long-term data, or if you want to look at trends. And so you need commitment to be able to collect those long-term data. So I just want to give you one example. The Turtle River Watershed Association came to me a number of years ago because they were concerned that the loons on their lake were declining. The Turtle River Watershed Association is similar to the Hubbard COLA in that it's an association of multiple lakes. There are 12 lakes in this watershed association. And these are the data that they shared with me. This is the number of pairs from 2004 to 2014. In 2009, it looked like there were no loons, and in 2014, the numbers were low, but otherwise, it looked like numbers might be increasing. They also shared this chart. This here, again, from 2004 to 2014, it's a total count of loons. And when they sent this data, it only had four of their 12 lakes on it, so Turtle River, Mobile, Lower Lindgren, and Stump. And one thing I noticed is that Stump Lake, for example, was only seen in two of the years, so were they seeing zero birds in the other years? So I asked the Watershed Association to send me their raw data. I wanted to see what was behind these charts. And this is what they sent. This might not be easy to see, but I'll explain it. Each row is a lake, and then each column is a different year of data collection. And you might not be able to read all the numbers, but what I want to point out is a few things. The Big Turtle Lake, they actually had split into a couple different areas, but they didn't consistently track the numbers. So one year they only did the southern part of Big Turtle. Long Lake's another one where they were surveying the whole lake, and then one year they only checked the northwestern part. Well, when you're looking at data through time, that can be really hard to understand if you're not clear about what parts of the lake are being surveyed, and you certainly can't compare a whole lake survey to a partial lake survey. The other thing I noticed is they had a lot of data with no information in it. And when I asked them about this, are they supposed to be zeros or was there no data collected? And they said there was no data collected. So all these dark gray boxes are years that no data were collected. And what they were doing is they were summing all the late data for the lakes that they did collect data, and those were the data they were sharing with me. So they weren't looking at consistent surveying through time. It's sort of a snapshot of different lakes every year. And it's really hard to look at trends that way. And so at the very bottom, it's the count, it's how many lakes were included in the sum that they had. And even in a year when they had, even in 2 years where they had 11 lakes that were being counted, if you kind of scroll up the column here, they had different lakes that were included in those 11 lakes. So again, you can't even compare those 2 years. So I gave them some advice, both in terms of data collection to make sure either a lake is gonna collect data or not, to try and be able to look at trends through time. And then I gave them some advice for how to represent their data in their reports. So a couple of points I want to make here is, if you want to talk about trends or you want to talk about changes through time, it's really important to have annual numbers so that you can make comparisons. The other point I would make is it's best if you can get the same person or group of people to do the surveys on the lake every year. And if that's not possible, I really encourage mentoring and working together. Because even if you're given a pretty rigorous protocol, you're making decisions when you're out in the field that maybe aren't represented in the protocol. And by working with others and sharing how you collect the data, you're passing on those individual decisions to other people collecting the data. So if getting involved in volunteer opportunities is something you want to do, particularly our loon monitoring surveys, you can go to our website and type in volunteers. You'll come to this page. And as you can see by the red arrows on the left, both of our loon surveys are listed here. Loon Watcher is the one that Hubbard COLA is submitting their data to. So that would be one that you might want to learn a little bit more about. And I know Sharon has more of the materials. I'm sure she'd be willing to distribute them from the person who's organizing. But also know we do have other volunteer science opportunities at the Minnesota DNR if you're interested. So So with that, I am happy to take some questions. Before I take questions, I did want to explain this little photo and let you know I'm going to, after I explain this photo, flip to my last slide, which has our contact information. This little story came to me last summer in 2019 in Wisconsin. It was reported that a mallard duckling was hanging out with loons. And they ended up creating a little story on Care 11. You can find it on YouTube if you're interested. But basically, these loons had a chick, and they lost their chick at the same time that this lone little mallard duckling showed up, and they adopted it. Now, normally, loons would kill baby mallards, but for whatever reason, this loon pair was lonely, and they ended up taking care of this little mallard duckling all summer, feeding it fish, teaching it to dive. So it was a nice little story. I'm going to go ahead and shift to my last slide, and I'm happy to answer any questions if folks want to verbalize them or if Sharon received anything in the chat. I'm happy to answer questions until you tell me we run out of time for questions.
Sure. I don't see anything in the Zoom group chat. Okay. And so anybody just speak up if you have a question. I think Christine will be able to hear you.
Sharon, this is Ken Grubb.
Hi, Ken.
I just want to say hi to Christine. And I can't believe it's been 7 years since you are no longer our AIS coordinator for Hubbard County. And I enjoyed your presentation as usual. You communicate well, enjoyed it. And congratulations on your assistant manager position for the Northwest region. So it's a great growth for you, and I always enjoyed working with you. And as usual, hugs.
Aw, thanks. I love working with you guys too, which is why I should have probably handed this over to Amy, but I told her I wanted to do it. So I'm here because I think Hubbard is a great organization, and I enjoy giving presentations, and I like meeting up with people that I've seen over the years. So I appreciate that, and it's good to hear from you too, Ken.
Thank you. And Andrea Dutcher says, very nice presentation also, Christine.
Thank you.
Other questions?
May I?
Go ahead, Debbie.
Okay, thanks. So I'm on Fifth Crow Wing. Our loons, we've got a loon platform that they've used for literally decades. This year, their first two eggs, they only have them for about 2 weeks, and then there was a big commotion in the night that neighbors heard, and the next morning the platform was damaged and flooded, so we lost that first batch. A few days later, we repaired the platform as best we could, and a few days later the loons had another couple of eggs on there, so we were all thrilled, and we expected those to hatch middle of July, which is kind of late, but the second clutch was laid in the second week of June. Well, July 11th came and went, and we had no babies, and then all of a sudden the loons were off of the platform, and we had one egg still on there and one egg that was no longer on there. No sign of a baby. So we're not sure what happened. I'm not sure if that egg is still on the platform, but I had heard at some point that sometimes the DNR would like to have that egg to kind of determine what happened. Is that still true? And should I go down and see if it's still there?
We were collecting eggs as part of our investigation to understand whether Minnesota's loons had been exposed to oil and dispersants from the BP oil spill. We have finished that project right now, so we're not collecting loons or eggs. We were collecting dead loons as well, but we don't have the funds to do the analysis. And so for right now, we're not taking eggs or loon part. We will take dead loons because research facilities will take them, but generally we don't have a lot of storage space, so we're not collecting eggs. Thank you for the offer. And if it's been out in the sun for a long time, often even if there's genetic material, it's not very useful then. What I will say is to have a second clutch of loon eggs is very unusual. And whether they're waterfowl or small, many of the small birds, when they do a second nest, often it's not as successful. They often won't have as many eggs, and sometimes they're not fertilized as well. And so I'm not surprised that you didn't have any young. And the fact that there was only one egg there Sometimes if the adults don't feel movement in the egg by a certain point, they can tell that the egg is dead and they'll actually just kick it out of the nest. And so it's possible some of these things happened and they didn't realize till late, or maybe even a partially developing bird didn't make it, or the adults actually realized it was getting too late for them to even finish nesting and they actually chose to just abandon ship. So there are a lot of things that can go wrong when you're laying eggs and taking care of babies, but I'm surprised to hear that they laid another set of eggs. Not as surprised to hear that they didn't make it.
Last year they laid two sets as well. The first set froze. We had that late freeze.
And oh, interesting.
The second set, and those were successful twins that made it. So
okay. Wow. So you have a very healthy pair. You know, to produce four eggs is a lot of energy. So yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
How about one more question?
He had a second pair. A second set of eggs on Beltane in our bay. We lost eggs around June 10th, 12th, something like that. And then they rebred, and we had two born on 4th of July that we named Betsy and Ross. but they seem to be doing really well. They were born on the 4th of July.
All right. Maybe there's more of that going on. I know we do hear of some late hatches every now and then, and there's always a little bit of anxiety whether or not they'll be big enough to fly by the time winter comes around. So it is a risk for the adults to do the extra clutch too. But if you have overachievers that are starting early and having their nests freeze, maybe they are starting early enough that it isn't too big of a deal to try a second nest.
Great.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, thank you for having me. I told Sharon that I would share my actual presentation, so I will send that out tomorrow. And again, thanks for having me, and enjoy the rest of the meeting. If you've got any questions for the non-game specialists or myself, please feel free to email us. We are working from home right now, so a phone call is probably not the most efficient way to get a hold of us. But thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Christine, so much. All right, we'll talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.